Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 20th of January. First hour of our program today, we have two great guests who will be talking about what Congress is working on, the health care repeal law passed by the House yesterday, and whether or not there is much more of a tone of civility in Washington after the horrors of Tucson. We'll have a great discussion and a thorough discussion of Joe Lieberman, who decided after five terms in the Senate that he's not going to seek his fifth term. After four terms in the Senate, he is going to be leaving, and we'll look at how he really irritated a lot of Democrats by what he did. Was he, though, on the whole, a good Democrat? Why did he decide to leave? Why did he decide to campaign for John McCain? We'll look at all of those issues. Glenn Thrush from Politico joining us, the first part of the program. Steve Kornacki, news editor and columnist for Salon, will be joining us a little bit later. Today is, if you can believe it, as you heard on the news, the 50th anniversary of the inauguration of President John Kennedy. And it is also the 50th anniversary this week of Dwight Eisenhower farewell address, in which he talked about the military-industrial complex. We will have two guests with us, the author of Ask Not, The Inauguration of John F. Kennedy and the Speech That Changed America, which is a very thorough examination of the weeks prior to the inaugural, who had input on the writing of the inaugural, what was going on with family members, how they decided what they were going to wear, how the president rehearsed the way he was going to deliver the speech. And we'll also hear some clips from those very famous speeches, hour number two of our program. Both hours, you're welcome to join the conversation. Glenn Thrush is joining us the first part of this hour. Our number is 800-486-8655. And our email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@WPR.org. Glenn covers Capitol Hill for Politico. He was with Newsday for a few years before that, the last three in Washington. He also worked in the basement of New York City Hall, where, as he says, he annoyed Mayor Michael Bloomberg. He's a veteran of Bloomberg News, former editor of City Limits, a monthly that covered low-income neighborhoods in New York. And he is our guest. He really knows what's going on in Washington. He really knows what's going on. He's the White House correspondent now for Politico, and we'll be welcoming a couple phone calls for him, and then later we'll concentrate on Joe Lieberman. Hello, Glenn.
Hi.
Thanks for being with us.
Oh, no problem.
So let's talk about what happened yesterday, and that was the House voting to repeal Obama's health care law. It looks like we're going to be talking about health care forever. Why did they do this? Just to make a point that they could?
Well, I think it's a couple of reasons. First of all, yes, is the short answer. I think this, you know, we're really seeing the Republican majority in the House serving the base as they move forward. And I mean, I think this is part of new Speaker John Boehner's plan of kind of dealing with these, sort of flushing through these politically popular but not necessarily programmatically viable pieces of legislation. So that is a key component to that. But I think there's also something else going on here. And I think this is part of a multi-pincered approach from the opponents of health care reform to sort of attack it at all angles. I mean, the biggest threat that the White House views to health care reform is this 20-state lawsuit that's winning its way through the court.
Right.
But I think there is a sense among Mitch McConnell and John Boehner that if you mount enough political pressure, you can sort of catch this in a bit of a vice. What I think is most interesting about this, however, is the one group that's been really silent on this repeal stuff and hasn't been banging the drum are the insurance companies,
mm-hmm.
who seem to be somewhat satisfied with the deal that they were able to extract from the Obama administration last
mm-hmm.
year.
We had Wendell Potter on a couple weeks ago, and he said, don't expect anything significant other than a few tweaks to happen because the lobbyists are already in full force in Washington since the new Congress has been sworn in. And they really wrote the health care bill, he said, and they also give a lot of money to members of Congress, so don't expect a big change. Do you think he was right?
Yeah, and I think this remember, a few changes, and some of them are quite significant, like the 1099 provision that impacts businesses. A bunch of these changes are backed by the administration and other Democrats as well. So Obama can make a viable case that he is himself embarking on sort of a re-reform of the reform law. So, yes, I agree. But I also think there is, from a political perspective, there's no downside for the Republicans in both the Senate and the House to move against this. There was a very interesting poll came out this week, however, and it showed that outside of the most conservative Republican voters, there is not very much support in the country for repealing health care reform. Democracy Corps, working for a progressive group, estimated that it's around 17%. I saw another poll
really?
That had repeal support at 18%. So clearly, they don't have the wind at their backs, and I think they want to get this out of the way early.
And yet, they would have you believe that they do have the wind at their backs. We hear from all kinds of people who are in favor of repealing this that the American people doesn't want this.
Well, that's not true. I mean, I think Eric Cantor, the House Majority Whip, the number two to John Boehner, who is a very effective strategist and communicator for his party, very effective, has said just repeatedly over and over again that the American people don't want this. The only way to sort of interpret that as factual is to take the most narrow possible interpretation, and that is there are polls nationally that still show a majority, usually in the low mid 50s, in general don't support the Health Care Reform Act, but. You know, the paradox here has always been that when you break it down to its individual components, including the individual mandate, I think, the American people overwhelmingly support individual components, particularly, getting rid of the pre-existing condition barriers and insurance for 26-year-olds. So, overall, it doesn't poll very well, but when you start going after individual components, people support it. And that's really the White House's strategy, is to highlight these individual pieces.
Glenn, is there a history of major pieces of controversial legislation being passed, and then the House switches or the Senate switches, and there's an attempt to repeal the legislation that was just passed, or is this something new?
You know, that's a really great question. I don't know the history on this. I think there were some attempts to repeal Medicare and Medicaid back in the day, but I think what is most likely to happen in these instances is this erosion of it based on, and that really is where the Republicans, I think, do have some, if they are very serious about attacking this, where they really do have some opportunity to sort of pick away at this. But again, I think the more successful attempts have been through the courts. And we remember in the Schechter case with the National Recovery Act, the National Recovery Administration in the 30s, that led to the FDR's court packing scheme that overturned major pieces of New Deal legislation. So typically it's the courts that provide the best avenue for opponents of this stuff, because typically the courts are stocked with previous administration appointees.
Mm-hmm. And considering the number of states that have filed against this health care reform, is it your belief that the Supreme Court will have the final word here?
Well, I think that's almost everybody's assumption, unless we have some sort of an earthquake that we can't perceive here. And it's almost certainly going to come down to Justice Anthony Kennedy and whether and how he sort of interprets the Commerce Clause. And whether or not, this is constitutional. I mean, so you really have massive multi-trillion-dollar industry and this huge problem in terms of America's debt moving forward poised on this pinpoint, and that is Anthony Kennedy.
It all boils down to Anthony Kennedy, really?
That's it. Buy him lunch. I don't think you're allowed to buy him lunch, but for folks to buy him lunch. This is why, these Supreme Court battles are so fundamentally important, and how small variations in the court can really tip things.
Yeah. So do you notice a difference in tone in Washington this week?
Yes.
You do?
I mean, absolutely. I don't want to be... I hate to shed my typical cynicism here, and I'm sure that attitude is never rewarded in D.C. But I really do sense that that people are chastened by all of this. And I don't know how much of that is sort of sincere civic-mindedness or the fear of being perceived as going over the line. But there's definitely a shift in tone and a shift in language. And I, for one, hope it sticks for a while.
And do you think it will?
I do. I think it's going to stick for a while.
Really?
Yeah, no, I really do. And, you know, I am perhaps a very lonely man in this respect. But I think, I really do think, and if you're looking at the polling today, you know, President Obama has rebounded from the mid-40s to the low 50s in the past 7 to 14 days. And it's almost entirely attributable to the way that independent moderate voters view him as moving towards the center. I think there is a real sense among people that despite the turnover in Congress in the last election, that what they want is sort of moderate, responsible, non-extreme leadership.
Mm-hmm. And wouldn't it be absolutely amazing if Congresswoman Giffords is able sometime to return?
It would. I think it would hearten. I think it would. You know, these relatively small matters have a big impact on the way that that Congress works. And these people, you know, despite the combat that you see, I mean, there really are a lot of relationships across the aisle. And there was some encouraging news I hear out of Tucson today, actually Houston today, in that Representative Giffords was apparently for the first time able to stand. So
I read that. Isn't that remarkable?
It is.
Yeah, it just kind of takes your breath away. That sometimes you just can't explain how some things happen. But you've got, my mom always used to say, things happen for a reason. In this case, you have to believe that's true. It happened for a reason, not the shooting and everything, but her survival, which adds yet another layer to a story that has so much in it. Chinese President Hu Jintao is speaking before Congress this morning. Is that right?
Yes. Yesterday, I thought the big show, probably the most interesting, at least visual that you're going to see out of this, was the joint press conference yesterday, which was really just sort of a, you know, if you're a reporter, it was a feast. The body language itself was just delicious, because both leaders, and they are both extraordinarily sophisticated politicians, had very complicated mandates. You know, whose basic message to the United States was that we are friendly, we are trading partners, but we are growing to be a rival superpower to the United States, both military and economically. And we're tired of being lectured by you guys. President Obama, on the other hand, had a very delicate dance yesterday, which was to sort of project America's disappointment with the valuation of the Chinese currency, which is hurting American workers and export capacity, while also sort of smoothing over what has been a very rocky year of U.S.-China relations. So it was a very funny press conference, exacerbated by sort of the Saturday Night Live element of the translator apparently completely screwing everything up.
Oh, no. You can't do that, not when it's that important. And how does he happen to be going to Chicago? Who worked that out?
That was kind of a late ad. I don't really know a lot about that one, but in this administration, all roads lead to Chicago. So
you're right.
Eventually, everybody wins.
You're right. I thought you were going to say one of the most delicious things was, and I rarely pay attention to this, but I got to say, First Lady Michelle Obama's dress was a knockout.
It was. And the thing I really like, and how do I put this delicately, I had a mother who was taller than my father, so this is not, but she is entirely unafraid of being taller than her husband, which I think is just a victory for everybody.
Yeah, I agree.
And he's cool with that, too, which is great.
Right, yeah, he's cool with a lot of things, it would appear. Well, thank you, Glenn. It's always a great pleasure to have you here. Do you want to make a comment before we get into a long discussion about Joe Lieberman leaving? Were a lot of people happy about that, or did they?
Well, I think a lot of people on the left, and I can tell you, you know, a lot of reporters are not happy because Joe Lieberman was one of the most intriguing and quotable guys around, and a very, very canny politician. And he's going to be a hard act to follow.
Thank you so much, Glenn. We'll talk to you again soon. Thanks.
Take care.
Glenn Rush, who's a frequent guest on our program, he is the White House correspondent for Politico and does an if you go to Politico, he writes so much. It's just amazing. He really does a great job of filling us in on all that's going on in Washington, D.C. We're going to continue our conversation and center on the announcement from Joe Lieberman that he's not going to be running for a fifth term and look at his very interesting past, how he first got into the Senate, the races that he had, who he was running against. And of course, he irritated many Democrats for his positions on issues, but I think the final straw was probably when he campaigned pretty much front and center for Senator John McCain for the presidency. So we'll talk about him and about his work in the Senate and welcome your phone calls. We'll change guests here. Steve Kornacki joining us in a moment, news editor and columnist for Salon, who has written extensively about Joe Lieberman. Here's our phone number. Join us, please. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. And the second hour of our program today, today is the 50th anniversary of John Kennedy's inauguration and his inaugural address, which was considered one of the most important addresses and most beautifully written addresses of the 20th century. We will hear some of that. It also is the 50th anniversary earlier this week of Dwight Eisenhower's farewell address, which also has received a great deal of attention over the past 50 years. So we'll look at both of those and have two guests with us. That's coming up, hour number two. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Steve Kornacki is joining us now, news editor for Salon. He's previously written about politics for the New York Observer and Roll Call, and he's also done work for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and on the Daily Beast. He has written extensively. You may want to look up the articles that he's written just this week about Joe Lieberman. Yesterday's piece, The Making and Unmaking of Joe Lieberman, who has announced his retirement from the Senate after four terms. We'll look at how he got into the Senate and why he has been so controversial and not always a guy that the Democrats were happy with, although on some issues they were very happy with him, and why he was chosen as the vice presidential candidate, et cetera. Please join the conversation, 800-486-8655. Hi, Steve.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing very well.
Good. You know, when you think about certain people in the Senate or certain people in public life and the amount of airtime they've received, Joe Lieberman is way up there. It's hard to imagine the news without Joe Lieberman, isn't it?
Yeah, and something tells me I'm not exactly sure what his next step will be after he leaves the Senate in 2 years. But something tells me we probably haven't heard the last from him. I mean, I assume, you know, he'll probably end up at some kind of think tank, maybe some kind of academic setting, somewhere where he sort of has a perch to kind of speak out. I think particularly on foreign policy, national security issues. So I imagine we'll still be hearing from him, but Democrats won't have to worry about him, joining any of those nasty filibusters in the Senate anymore.
Right. So why did he hang it up?
You know, I think it's pretty simple. He had no options left. I mean, the reality was, you know, he couldn't go back and run as a Democrat and win a Democratic primary in Connecticut. Obviously he had lost the primary by 4 points back in 2006. You could have made a case back then, you know, after he came back and won in the fall as an independent, you could have made a case then that, hey, you know, he's got 6 years to get back in the good graces of the Democratic Party and maybe be their candidate again come 2012. But what did he do when he went back to the Senate? He teamed up with John McCain, went out, campaigned for him for president, spoke at the Republican convention, really kind of burned those bridges permanently with the Democrats. So that option was off the table. You know, the second option would be the Republican Party. The idea of maybe he switches and runs as a Republican. The problem is, as much as he continued sort of poking sticks in the eyes of the Democrats these last few years, he never sort of went all in with the Republican agenda. There were just too many occasions, I think, when he refused to join them, whether it was on blocking health care last year or in
you know, in Don't Ask, Don't Tell in the lame duck session recently. So there just really weren't any prospects of him winning a Republican nomination, and I think much more likely, you know, a conservative candidate would run in a primary against him if he ever tried to do that and would beat him in the primary, because there was plenty of room to Joe Lieberman's right. And then the final option would be, well, okay, you know, forget the Democrats, forget the Republicans, run as an independent like he did in 2006. The difference is, if you look at his poll numbers in Connecticut now with just independent voters, they're much, much worse than they were back in 2006. I mean, his overall approval rating in the state is somewhere in the 30%,
really,
35% range. So you run as an independent, probably going to come in a distant third place. So I think he looked at that and said, better to call it quits now and you know, pretend it's a voluntary move.
Hmm. Many have not fully understood, and you'll be able to fill us in here. He must have known in his heart of hearts that campaigning for John McCain was going to make a lot of people pretty upset with him. Why did he do that?
I think there are a couple of things to consider, and most of this is conjecture. I mean, the simplest one is he developed in the last, you know, decade or so a really close relationship with John McCain within the Senate, even before 2006. Sort of the events of 2006, when the Democrats sort of turned on Lieberman, really drew Lieberman and McCain much closer together. He saw McCain as one of the very few friends in the Senate he could really count on. So I think he felt a measure of you know, personal loyalty to McCain, combined with just, you know, still sort of hard feelings towards the Democratic Party and the Democratic establishment heading into 2008. So I think that was one of the factors. I think here's where I get into conjecture, but I really do believe this. I believe that he thought, and I've got to believe he had conversations with John McCain where they both sort of talked around this idea that John McCain, if he could, if he was in position to, would make Joe Lieberman his running mate in 2008. There's never been official confirmation of that, but there have been plenty of stories out there that suggest that's the direction McCain wanted to go, and his advisors had to talk him out of it and had to tell him, no, we can't put Joe Lieberman's name before this convention as the running mate. So I think that was another factor. And the third one that I consider that it John Chait from the New Republic advanced yesterday, and I think makes some sense, is that Lieberman really did kind of buy into this notion that a lot of sort of skeptical, you know, moderate conservative, neoconservative Democrats and even Republicans had, and that was that Barack Obama was just going to be another, you know, he was the caricature. He was a George McGovern. He was going to just, you know, go into the presidency, govern far from the left and fail miserably, and Joe Lieberman would be vindicated. And I think he might have had that calculation, too.
Mm, interesting. And yet he must have realized how historic the election was. And so it struck me as unusual because it was the first African-American running at this level for office. So that was striking to me. Let's go back to, I didn't realize what the background here was. Let's go back to the run for the Senate in Connecticut in 1988, when the Republican is probably more of a Democrat than Joe Lieberman has become, and that was Lowell Weicker.
Yeah, I haven't confirmed this for sure, but I think the 1988 Senate election in Connecticut was the last time in American political history that the National Review endorsed the Democratic candidate and the National Organization for Women endorsed the Republican candidate.
That's something.
It was an amazing sort of set of circumstances. I mean, Lowell Weicker, for people who don't remember him, he's about 79, 80 years old right now. He's sort of been out of the spotlight for at least 15 years. But he was really the last of the real, authentic liberal Republicans in the Senate. I mean, there's this whole species that no longer exists, the Rockefeller Republican.
Right.
But that's what Lowell Weicker was. I mean, you know, very liberal on cultural issues, abortion and gay rights and civil rights and affirmative action, gun control, all these things. He voted against the Reagan budgets in the 80s. He would fight Jesse Helms on AIDS funding, on education funding, all these sorts of things. All of the liberal groups would give him better ratings than most of the Democrats in the Senate. So he was running for re-election in 1988, and obviously it's sort of the conservative establishment in the Republican Party absolutely despised him. And the general consensus heading into that election was, well, if Weicker's in trouble, it'll be because there'll be a Republican primary challenge. And for a variety of reasons, he was able to avoid a Republican primary challenge. The candidate who was supposed to run against him just decided at the end that he just wasn't going to be able to raise the money. So it looked like Weicker was all set to win a fourth term in the Senate. And then Joe Lieberman, who was the Attorney General of Connecticut at the time, decided he was going to get in the race. He was pretty much dismissed from people by observers at the beginning. You know, there's no chance this guy can win. Weicker's unbeatable. And what he put together was this. He ran to Weicker's right. He staunchly supported the death penalty. Weicker opposed it. And the death penalty was a much bigger issue back then, I think, than it is now. Very, you know, stressed his sort of religious, that he's, you know, devoutly religious, and really played up sort of his hawkishness on foreign policy, and his support of the Reagan administration's policies, for instance, on Nicaragua. You remember the whole Iran-Contra thing. And so in that climate, you know, you had the National Review just in William F. Buckley actually set up a political action committee to help Lieberman, and Lieberman pulled off an upset, won the race by 10,000 votes. And then if you look at where the votes came from, you know, he basically won by attracting the conservatives in the state who had voted for Ronald Reagan, and they switched and voted for Joe Lieberman. And that's how he got in the Senate.
Amazing. You mentioned in your article yesterday that the National Review, in one of their 1988 headlines, writes, which is hard to imagine, "Does Lowell Weicker make you sick?" Oh, man. Oh, my. I'm wondering if he's always been what somebody described, and you cite this in your article, every Republican's favorite Democrat.
Yeah, I wouldn't say so, because when he got to the Senate, and I mean, and this is still true now, if you look at Lieberman's voting record, you know, he's still generally, you know, a liberal vote in the Senate, you know, and I think that's a lot of the sort of, you know, sort of progressive activist community has been really frustrated the last 4 years at the idea that, you know, Joe Lieberman goes out and campaigns for John McCain and Harry Reid doesn't kick him out of his committee assignments, or, you know, all of that stuff. The reality is, you know, on a lot of the votes that don't get a lot of headlines, and a lot of important procedural votes, Lieberman was always there for the Democrats and really still is there for the Democrats. So he's more important to them, you know, to the Democrats in the Senate than people realize. And I think in his first years in the Senate, you know, he was generally, you know, a reliable vote for the Democrats. I think what happened was there were a couple things. What really kind of made him into a national figure in the late 90s was the Clinton impeachment, ordeal. And Lieberman had made some friends on the right, most notably Bill Bennett, the sort of, you know, cultural conservative commentator. Lieberman had sort of teamed up with Bennett in the mid-1990s on, you know, going after video games and Hollywood and sort of violence in popular culture, violence and sort of coarseness in popular culture. They had sort of formed an alliance there. And then when the Clinton stuff started coming out, Lieberman went farther than any Democrat in the Senate in expressing, he never actually called for Clinton to resign, but he came very close. He went to the Senate floor. He gave a very memorable speech in September 1988, 1998, where he really sort of called Clinton out on his personal conduct and in a way that other Democratic senators didn't do. And Al Gore remembered that, because Al Gore then 2 years later is running for president, and, you know, he really believed, you know, you can debate this for all of history, but he really believed that the obstacle keeping him from the presidency in 2000 was Bill Clinton, was Clinton fatigue, was people not wanting to give Bill Clinton a third term, and he thought, who better to put on the ticket than the Democrat who went farther than anybody else in the party in separating himself from Bill Clinton. So that was the tiebreaker. You remember the final two choices for Al Gore for his running mate in 2000 were John Kerry and Joe Lieberman. And the tiebreaker was Lieberman spoke out against Clinton.
Hmm. Interesting. Were they buddies, Gore and Lieberman?
No, not at all. They really weren't before. I mean, they had, you know, Gore had served in the Senate with Lieberman for 4 years. So I think it was a cordial relationship, but there's no indication that they were really that close. And of course, the postscript on the 2000 story is what was always more interesting to me. You know, Lieberman was so grateful to Gore for putting him on the ticket, because Lieberman was, you know, heading into 2000, nobody was looking at Joe Lieberman saying, this guy is, you know, vice presidential timber. You know, Gore is the guy who decided on that. You know, people weren't putting him on shortlists. So Lieberman was so grateful for that. You know, he wanted himself to run for president in 2004, but he said publicly and repeatedly, I will not run in 2004 unless Al Gore, if Al Gore wants to run. And Gore, you know, was, you know, kept everybody guessing till the end of 2002. Lieberman stayed true to his word, stayed out of the race. Only in December 2002 did Al Gore finally announce he wouldn't run. At that point, Lieberman got in, you know, and started finally making the moves he needed to run. And then a year later, Al Gore sort of out of nowhere announces that he's going to endorse Howard Dean for the Democratic presidential nomination.
Yes.
Never actually even got to tell Joe Lieberman personally before he did it. And Lieberman made a comment that day when people asked him about it, and he said, "I'm not going to make any comments today about the vice president's sense of loyalty."
Uh-huh.
And their relationship obviously has never been anything like it once was.
Right. Did he help the ticket, do you think, in 2000?
You know, it's tough to say. I don't think he heard it. You know, the ironic thing is, this is one of those things, again, we can debate for all time, but in a way, he might have won the election for the ticket and then lost it for the ticket. And what I mean by that is, I think the presence of the first Jewish American on a major national ticket energized, obviously, a lot of Jewish voters, especially older Jewish voters, in America, but particularly, where they're sort of, a lot of them, and that's Florida. And you remember, of course, the controversy on election day in 2000
with
that really confusing ballot in areas with heavy elderly Jewish populations, where Pat Buchanan, of all people, suddenly started getting all these votes because people thought they were voting for the Gore-Lieberman ticket, but it actually ended up being Pat Buchanan's third-party ticket. So I think a lot of those people were voters who were probably energized by the presence of Joe Lieberman on the ticket. If their original preference had been registered, it probably would have been enough to carry Florida for the ticket, which obviously would have been enough to put Gore and Lieberman in power. But because of that error, among many other things, Florida ends up being declared for Bush.
Yeah. What a race that was. I want to go back and read about
it. We can relitigate that for hours.
Yeah, we sure could. We welcome phone calls. Please join our conversation. I've been remiss. I should give you the phone number again in case you forgot. Steve Kornacki is our guest, and we're talking about Joe Lieberman and his announcement. Was it yesterday or the day before? It was yesterday, right? It was yesterday. That he is not seeking a fifth term in the U.S. Senate. And Steve has written a piece that's in Salon yesterday. He's written several pieces about Joe Lieberman, but a very interesting piece about the making and unmaking of Joe Lieberman that was posted yesterday. If you go to Salon and look under Joe Lieberman, you will find this. It looks at his race against Lowell Weicker in 1988 and how the Democrats were really more closely aligned with Weicker and the Republicans with Lieberman, and how that all played out and who had support from whom. It's a very interesting piece. Will you miss his being in the Senate? Do you think that he's been a valuable senator? Some of you who are, what do you think? Was he the Republicans' favorite Democrat? We welcome your phone calls. Here's the number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. And we'll also be speaking with Steve about who is likely to, there already have been people expressing interest, who's likely to be a front runner in replacing him. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program, it was 50 years ago today that John Kennedy was inaugurated as President of the United States and gave a speech that was, by many accounts, a stirring, rousing, beautiful speech, one of the best political speeches, not really a political speech, one of the best speeches from a statesman in the 20th century. One of our guests has written, Thurston Clark, a real lengthy and very interesting book about that particular address and all that was going on in Kennedy's mind and his aide's mind, and why he said what he said and the themes that were present in other speeches that he had given that made their way to the inaugural, what was going on with Jackie and the children and his mother and his father and his brother and his sisters in those couple weeks before the inaugural. It's a fascinating book. He will be one of our guests. It also is the 50th anniversary of Dwight Eisenhower's farewell address, which has received an enormous amount of attention in the past 50 years as well. So we'll be looking at that address. Should be a highly interesting hour. Steve Kornacki, news editor, columnist for Salon, is our guest. And let's start our phone calls with Mike from South Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Hi, I'd just like the guest to fill us in about Joe Lieberman in Israel. Talk about Joe and his being the protector of Israel. I'd like to hear his comments.
Well, you say, you know, the protector of Israel. I mean, I think, you know, one thing that, you know, Lieberman obviously is you know, his career is sort of, you know, staunch supporter of Israel. That's sort of been one of his calling cards for years. And I think one of the reasons why he's sort of grown apart from some Democrats when it comes to foreign policy is that that just absolute sort of unblinking support of Israel is no longer as automatic within the Democratic Party, I think, as it used to be. It's interesting, I think, on the question of Israel, the two parties have sort of changed roles a little bit through the years. The Republican Party, you know, historically was, you know, you talk about Dwight Eisenhower and in his closing speech from the White House, you know, the Republican Party traditionally embodied more of sort of an Eisenhower approach to the Middle East and to foreign policy, sort of a realist approach. In the Democratic Party was historically more the party of, you know, Daniel Patrick Moynihan and Scoop Jackson and a lot of the people whose foreign policy views are very similar to Joe Lieberman's. The Democratic Party has somewhat moved away from that, and a lot of its base, I think, has moved away from that in recent years, while the Republican Party has grown much much stronger and more strident, I think, in its support of Israel and its government. And I think that's something that's probably frustrated Lieberman and probably plays a role in his drift from the establishment on foreign policy.
Chris in Oshkosh, hi.
Hi. I wanted to comment a little bit on Joe Lieberman and the presidency and maybe the impact that he could have had on the presidency and on this country. And as a left-leaning voter who very much believes in the political center and that's what's good for this country, I'm kind of intrigued by guys like Lieberman and John McCain who didn't walk in step with their party but made decisions that maybe they thought were right at the time, even if I don't agree with all of their positions. And your guest talked a little bit about the Florida situation. I was elated when Gore picked Lieberman as his running mate. And I can't help but wonder how our country might be different today had Florida swung the other way and we would have had a man like Lieberman in the White House working with Al Gore.
Mm.
And then fast forward a little bit to the more current election where I'm pretty happy with the job that Barack Obama has done, but I had always said that if John McCain ran for president, he very well might get my vote. And I thought what we saw in that election was John McCain really turn away from himself and tie himself more to the right wing of the party. And the Sarah Palin pick just cemented that. And quite honestly, had he picked Lieberman, and I was shocked that he did, I probably would have voted for him. And I tend to think a lot of independents would have. I think there's a good chance McCain might have won that election. So he really had an opportunity to have a big impact, and I think it's a little sad that in two cases that impact is lost.
Thanks, Chris, for your comments. Steve?
You know, it's interesting to me because I've thought about this a lot. If something had played out differently in 2000 and Gore and Lieberman had ended up being sworn in as the president and vice president in January 2001, if we still have the attack on 9/11, then I think, you know, you'd still hear those calls that we heard and that were heard very clearly within the Bush White House to make an attack on Iraq and to make toppling Saddam Hussein part of the response to 9/11. I think that's something that obviously Joe Lieberman very strongly supported. He was one of the top supporters of the war and the idea of the war in the Senate, and he was one of the top proponents throughout the 1990s after the first Gulf War, between the two wars with Iraq. He was one of the top proponents in the Senate for the idea of regime change in Iraq. So, you know, one of the stories, I think, about the Bush White House in the days, weeks, and months after 9/11 was, you know, that you had this president who was surrounded by voices who just passionately believed, as a matter of principle, that, you know, the United States needed at some point to overthrow Saddam Hussein. If Al Gore had been in the White House and if in days, weeks, and months after 9/11. And if Joe Lieberman had been his vice president, then I think we know pretty clearly that one of the most prominent voices in Al Gore's ear would have been somebody with that exact same worldview, that exact same philosophy. I think the question is, you know, who else would have been around them? We don't know that. And how much would that have impacted Al Gore? Because the interesting thing with Al Gore to me is, if you look at his career in the Senate, before he became vice president, he was very similar to Joe Lieberman on foreign policy. He was a strong supporter of the Gulf War back in 1991. He was one of only 11 Democrats in the Senate who voted to authorize the first Gulf War. That was very unpopular with Democrats, but he and Joe Lieberman provided two of the 11 votes in the Senate for it. He was very strong on the missile programs that Ronald Reagan advocated in the 1980s, and he ran for president himself in 1988 as a hawk. He called himself a hawk on the campaign trail. So Al Gore had sort of a transformation. I'm not sure exactly when it happened, but we all saw it in public view in 2002 when he came out and opposed the war in Iraq, opposed the march to war in Iraq. And that was very jarring to people who'd followed him for years because, you know, the Al Gore of the 1980s and early 1990s would have been all for the idea of toppling Saddam Hussein. Now, I don't know if what triggered that with Al Gore, if that was in some way a response to, you know, losing the election in 2000 and all the soul searching that ensued from that, and did his philosophy, did his worldview change as a result of that? You know, would he have not undergone that process if he'd won the election in 2000, and if he'd won, and if he had Joe Lieberman next to him saying we've got to move to Iraq now? You know, I've gone over this question a lot in my head. I've talked to a lot of people about it. I don't really have an answer, but I think that would have been obviously probably the most pivotal issue facing a Gore Lieberman White House, and I really don't know how they would have handled it.
And do you think that if McCain had chosen Lieberman, the chances of that ticket being elected would have been greater than having Palin?
Very tough to say. I think in the general election, it's hard to say it wouldn't have helped McCain, or at least not hurt him as much as Palin. I mean, generally, you know, it's a truism, you know, for all the talk we devote to vice presidential candidates, they have remarkably little impact on election day. I saw a study by a political scientist that said that Palin's presence on the ticket probably cost McCain 1.6 points in the 2008 election, which actually would be a lot as far as vice presidential candidates go. I don't think Lieberman would have done that. I mean, the question is, would you have, if you picked him, would you have had a revolt within the Republican Party at the convention in 2008? And that was what McCain was warned about. You can't pick him because there'll be a floor fight. There'll be moves not to nominate him, not to accept this. You're John McCain. The party base already doesn't trust you. You can't force this kind of thing on them. I've been sort of skeptical that actually would have played out. And I've always kind of thought that if McCain picked Lieberman, Lieberman would have sort of very adroitly moved himself pretty dramatically, pretty quickly to the right on a number of sort of hot button issues, or would have at least sort of nuanced and fudged sort of his past cultural liberalism in a way that I think might have been agreeable to the party base. But I think it was the fear of what would have happened within the convention that and within the party that is what kept McCain from doing it.
Well, what does it say about him that he would do that, that he would change his mind on issues, that he really wants to win, or he's a man who doesn't have principles, or what?
Yeah, it's interesting, and I'm not sure. And he didn't go through with some of the changes. I thought, you know, for instance, you know, Joe Lieberman had always been even after 2006, and we saw this with Don't Ask, Don't Tell, he was very strong on gay rights. He always was one of the more liberal senators when it came to gay rights, when it came to, you know, Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, things like that. I thought that would be an issue where if John McCain had picked him in 2008 and you had cultural conservatives at the Republican convention saying, you know, we're going to revolt over this, that Joe Lieberman would have found a way to change his rhetoric, at least for that campaign, in a way that would satisfy the Republican base. Now, he didn't do that. And so I don't know. Maybe I'm completely wrong on that. I always thought that's something he would have done. We did see him, in the last few months in the Senate, change his tune on the issue of the Bush tax cuts. You know, in the early days of George W. Bush's presidency, he opposed the idea of cutting the tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans. The extension of those tax cuts you know, came up in the lame duck session just in December. And Joe Lieberman not only supported it, but he joined the Republicans in saying we should not consider any other legislation in this lame duck session until we extend these tax cuts for every American, meaning even the wealthiest Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So he had a clear flip-flop there. I think there was a strategic strategic calculation there on his part, and that was that he wanted to get don't ask, don't tell through, and he thought if he could side with the Republicans and help deliver them something that they really wanted on taxes, he might be able to peel off the critical support that he needed from those five or six Republicans who ended up defecting on don't ask, don't tell. And I think he might have, I think especially now that we know he was already planning to retire, he probably saw don't ask, don't tell as part of his legacy, and so he really wanted to deliver it. And so the tax cuts were sort of a means to that end.
Steve Kornacki from Salon is our guest this part of the program, news editor and columnist, and we're talking about Joe Lieberman, who's not going to be running again for the Senate, and what that means and who he is and who he has been. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and there are some lines open. You can also send an email. We haven't had any emails today. Well, let's have one, okay? The number or the address there is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Next caller is John from Appleton. Hi, John.
Hey, Colleen. So I just want to comment. I've always considered myself kind of a libertarian, which is to say very far left on socialists and very far right on conservative issues. And with the exception of Lieberman's views on gay rights, which I love, I've always found him to be quite irritating because he's basically a conservative on most social issues and liberal on most economic issues. But I tend to align with the Republican Party, and that's why I find it so odd that most Republicans say he's their favorite Democrat, because I feel like they're basically just endorsing the fact that he doesn't or never did exactly what the Democrats wanted, and they didn't actually look at any of his voting record or any actual facts about him. They just liked the fact that he was a thorn in the Democrat side, and so they supported him, regardless of the fact that he wasn't really in favor of the things that most Republicans are in favor of. So I think it just points to the issue that he was a divisive figure in that he didn't clearly align himself with anybody, but because most people just say, I'm for this and against that, the Republicans liked him despite the fact that he really wasn't for them in most ways. And so I just thought that was an interesting conundrum, and kind of points to the general voting populace's total ignorance.
Steve?
Well, except the last part, I do agree, I think, with the basic sentiment there. I think there's truth to that, but I think it sort of works two ways. I think it's true that a lot of Republicans, when you really kind of boil it down, the reason they liked Lieberman was that he bothered Democrats so much. They could easily pick up on that. They could easily see the rage that just the mention of Joe Lieberman's name could set off with Democrats, with liberals, and I think obviously they liked that. But I think it you look at it from the other angle, from the Democrats' angle. And I mentioned this earlier. Was he really the total, complete Benedict Arnold that he was sort of, it is sort of regarded as by the left? And I think if you look at it, sure, there are, you know, the war was obviously a huge issue, and standing with the Republicans on the Bush tax cuts last month was a big issue, or helping to block the public option that so many liberals wanted in the healthcare debate. You could call him a traitor for all of those things, but I think you also have to, if you're a liberal, you also have to look at the 80% or so of the time, even these last 4 years, where he still stood with Democrats, he still voted with them. Now, I mean, they can make the case that sure, a Democratic senator from Connecticut should be with the party line more than 80% of the time, and they're probably right that the Democratic senator from Connecticut can certainly get away with that in a state like Connecticut. But I wouldn't say he's a total sellout to sort of Democratic principles. I mean, his voting record simply makes a clear case otherwise.
We have about a minute and a half left. Who takes his place? Who's expressed interest?
It's interesting. I mean, the two names that are out there right now are a woman named Susan Bicewicz, who's the Connecticut Secretary of State. She was sort of seen as the next big thing in Connecticut politics a few years ago. She had a really rocky 2010, though. She started out running for governor, ended up dropping out, then decided to run for attorney general, then was forced to drop out because she was unqualified for the office because she wasn't a lawyer. So she has to overcome some of the negative reminders of that. The other name that's really out there is a guy named Chris Murphy, who's a younger congressman who was elected in 2006. He's known to be really ambitious, and I think it's pretty clear he's going to run. And
yeah, I think he announced his...
Will there be a wild card? And the one name I would put out there some say is a wild card, is Ted Kennedy Jr., who
really
lives in Connecticut, lives in the state, delivered that powerful eulogy last year.
And yes,
then,
he did.
You know, his name is certainly out there. I don't know if he's interested.
Hmm. And Murphy announced his bid this morning, I guess. So
that's right. I should say he's basically in. So, right.
He's in. Well, this has been fascinating. Thank you so much for being with us. It was a very interesting hour.
Happy to do it.
Thanks. Our guest this hour, Steve Kornacki. For most of the hour, Glenn Thrush also with us, talking about what's going on in Congress right now and a good chunk of time looking at the making and unmaking of Joe Lieberman. You can check out Steve's column on Joe, which is Joe Lieberman, Senator Lieberman, to be respectful, which is in yesterday's online yesterday in Salon, and well worth your reading. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the hour. Thanks to Chrissy for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We have news coming up, and then we should have a highly interesting hour. We love doing history, and this is recent history. To me, it seems like it was maybe 20 years ago, but we'll be looking at the inaugural address of John Kennedy, which was delivered today 50 years ago, and also Dwight Eisenhower's farewell address. Two great guests, and we'll hear some of those addresses as well. So we invite you to please stay tuned on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.